Kelly said the very first pump, he just was like, what the hell? This thing's insane. Ultra sensitive, ultra high performance. And, but if you sneak in the forgiveness and stuff, that they don't, you know, guys, top pro guys still want that too. A lot of those guys put the wide point forward. And so that creates a swing, which is fine. But then the average user, when the whole world of what that board can be, when you move the wide point back for the average user, turns into a whole different thing.
All right. Welcome to the Basis Surf Podcast. Super excited because we got Dan Mann. I'm excited because you're actually, if there was a stab in the dark for by surfboard reviewers, to the ones that I've talked to at least, you would have won. I talked to Tommy Surfs. He does great board reviews, and he picked several of your boards as like the most incredible boards, like the life-changing boards that he's had. And then surprisingly, on the other end of the spectrum, you got Noel Salas from Surfing Show. Mm-hmm. And he actually picked the Dominator 2 as his favorite small wave board.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I was like, huh, there's something here. And it's so interesting. And that's what I want to dig into at some point, because I'm like, because I was looking at the dims on the Dominator 2 and I'm like, these are so radically different from, you know, your typical, you know, small wave performance board. And I was like, how did, this would be super cool to chat with Dan. Mm-hmm. And then of course we can't not mention that, you know, Kelly Slater, like you shaped his FRK, and that's like his pretty much his go-to shortboard. So you got like all the way from Tommy, who's surfing like 2 to 3 foot, like crappy California beach break, to Kelly surfing perfect waves around the world, and somehow you ended up being the one that was chosen. So I'm super curious to get into all of that. So
cool.
Yeah, thanks for joining.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, you know, usually I like to just kind of get in and start from the beginning, because I think especially for a shaper, I'm curious like how your, you know, your entry into surfing and then the normal waves that you surf would influence the kind of boards that you do. So why don't we start at the beginning? You know, how did you get into surfing way back when?
So it definitely influenced the boards I make. So my dad was a late bloomer on surfing. He started surfing in his early 20s when he was in the Navy. And so by the time I was born 10 years later or so, he was super into it. And so as a little baby, he had me in the water on the front of his board and that kind of thing, from zero. Right. And, so as a kid growing up, we are always by the beach. And so I was able to surf, and then it got real serious for me around 11 and 12. And then, by 14, I was getting boards regularly and trying to get sponsored and doing all that stuff. And then by 18, I started really liking longboards. And so, but I definitely was primarily interested in the surfing you can do on a shortboard. Bigger.
And you were competing. You're like a competitive surfer, like comp guy. Okay.
Yeah. Got comp it. Kid and, you know, local, mostly local events and, but competing and, you know, God is, you know, it's a ruthless world, that level of competition. And, and then on the longboarding side, I had a lot more success on the competitive side, but I still definitely prefer the type of surfing you do on the shortboard. So,
And were you in like San Diego area, like North San Diego area, or where were you?
Yeah. South San Diego.
Okay, so,
South San Diego. And so I surfed mostly like La Jolla and south down to the border and then into Mexico a lot. So that those days it was really easy to, just take a morning and go down to Mexico. And so we'd surf the beach breaks in Northern Baja and the point breaks in the afternoon a lot. So, and then in my early 20s, I had some longboarding success as doing the Bud Pro Tour, if anyone remembers that, in the middle 90s. And then right when I was graduating college around 95, in 95 and 96, I was like, you know, every surfer who, because of my dad and the way his friends were with the approach to surfing was very holistic from the standpoint of you got to swim, don't surf with a leash. You got to, paddle long distances and just sail and canoe and, you know, just be fully. A lot of my growing up until I was 11 was in Hawaii. And so a lot of that, Hawaiian comprehensive water activity, you know, just being completely
right,
always involved in the water was a huge influence for me. So
interesting.
Yeah, I really liked and loved all the different kinds of boards and ways to ride a wave, body surfing, everything. So yeah. And so when it came time in the middle 90s, I needed to do a really long paddleboard race. I'd already started doing the Catalina, is a paddle race from the island of Catalina to the mainland of Los Angeles and Manhattan Beach. Mm-hmm. And that's a long race and real hard. And I felt like that was a good thing. And then I also wanted to make my own board. So by 95, 96, I was making my own boards.
Got it. And question for you then. So, mm-hmm. you know, you mentioned you were competing in longboarding. I mean, back then, was it like traditional longboarding or was it more high performance longboarding or what was it?
It's a good question, because back then there was a guy named Joey Hawkins, this guy, Jeff Kramer, Colin McPhillips and Ted Robinson were all ripping, and they were surfing longboards very progressively,
yeah.
still tip riding, but definitely you weren't scored negatively by surfing off the tail. And right. Taylor Jensen grew up in the same town as me, and he's 3-time world champ. So yeah. But now, and then Joel Tudor came along and you know, he's probably was winning events in the early 90s because he was a prodigy kind of surfer. But with his dominance, a lot of the guys started surfing very traditionally and right. trying to keep up with him. And I was like, well, I'll never keep up with him, and I'll never be able to do the traditional longboarding his way nearly as good as he could. So I just stay progressive, and that's what interested me anyway.
Yeah.
But then I wasn't that successful to stay with it, so I started shaping boards and getting it after it that way.
I mean, I find watching progressive longboarding kind of fascinating. I mean, I remember I was in the water and this guy was like tic-tacking like a 10-foot board, and I was just how is he moving? I mean, I guess he. Well, you tell me. Like, mm-hmm. how do you? Like, is he pushing just that hard on the tail to get it to like tic-tac or like?
Yeah. So that's a cool thing. See, like you can design the board with the rocker and the fin placements, and especially now with quads. I rode a lot of boards that were called twinsers, and now twinsers are starting to become a thing again. But Stu Kenson made my twinsers in 94, 95, 96. And because of the positioning of those, you could actually get a little, pendulum effect, like a little inertia going, so that once you get your first couple pumps going, then it's you know, those balls that go tick tick tick, you know, it's kind of like that. The trick is to not look overly aggressive and you know, to still have some smoothness, you know, obviously with longboarding, but yeah, you can get them going. You can, you know, I make a lot of 11 footers, so these boards I call all-in-ones or 11 foot and then down. A lot of the guys that I looked up to as surfers from 14 on would surf and paddle around these local point breaks on 12 foot boards so that they could go down the coast and then back up the coast, surf and paddle the whole way kind of thing. And so that kind of tour surfing is real interesting to me too. But yeah,
it's all coming together. Now I'm seeing all these different influences that are coming together. I'm like, that's very fascinating.
Uh-huh.
I didn't even know that there was a concept of like tour surfing, but the more I think about it, the more it makes sense.
Yeah. You know, especially depending on where you are. So Southern San Diego has Point Loma, like Palos Verdes, you know, and both those places have a lot of influence from paddleboarding, prone paddleboarding racing.
Yeah.
And so Northern San Diego, Cardiff and those guys, there's a lot of paddlers there. So yeah, it opens up a whole bunch of coasts for you.
Yeah. And I know that you're well known for just wanting to surf by yourself. Like, you know, you'll surf by yourself. And I guess that would be a good way to do it, is just paddle to somewhere no one else can paddle to, or no one
not
can
willing
surf.
To. Yeah.
yeah. That's a good strategy. Maybe I need to do that.
Yeah.
All right. So continue on. So you were competing, and then you you're trying all these different surf craft, and obviously that you're taking all that in, and then you start shaping. Like, what made you want to start shaping?
So initially it was more of a, okay, to be a fully committed surfer, I should make my own board and surf it, kind of just on a whim kind of thing. And I was working with a couple shapers that were willing to let me use their shaping room and things like that. So I had access and I could do it. And then once after about four or five boards, I'm like, you know, you can do a business with this, because especially back then, surfboard companies were really small, and it was really competitive. There wasn't a lot of money in it, but shapers were very much surfers first, then shapers. The further back you go, the more true that probably is. And right. Now there's some sophisticated business practices that go into some surfboard companies. But I saw an opportunity by just being responsible, answering my phone, and showing up and working hard. I knew I could outwork people. I grew up in restaurant business, so. And my dad and mom both worked really hard. So I knew how to work. And so I was like, okay, why don't I start? So I slowly and carefully started making it a business. I was lifeguarding and working at a restaurant at the time. And I was like, it was just a little side hustle. And then I was like, you know, I started getting more and more positive feedback and enjoying it. I really enjoyed making something, like having a block of foam and then turning into a board. It's like, whoa, man. And then this one time I watched a friend of mine, Jason, ride this little wing twin fin fishy thing that I made him, and he was flying and laughing. And I was like, that's pretty cool, man. You know? And so all those things kind of came together. And then, And then the graduation from college and wanting to have my own business, but not wanting to work weekends and holidays like restaurant business requires, kind of steered me towards manufacturing boards.
Right. And so what kind of boards did you start shaping? Were you shaping your comp boards for competition, or was it like your long boards, or like, what was it?
Everything. Yeah. It was mostly this little twin fin was really successful right away with my friends and me. And then.
And were twin fins popular back then?
Not really. Yeah. I was going off of the IPA, and a couple of us had some old IPAs and some Eaton. Mike Eaton is a San Diego old classic shaper. And who else? Well, and then my friend Stu, he was my shaper. He was the guy making Twinsers back then. He's a surfboard historian. His knowledge is incredible. And then the MR twin was probably one of our biggest influences too. And so not really popular, but those are the glass on fin days, no boxes. So the MR twin idea was what we were kind of chasing at the time.
And
it was easier to not screw those up than it was a high performance board. Like, going and making I just saw a board that Kelly was riding around that era. And it was so flipped and technical, and Al had shaped it by hand. And I was like, holy cow, you know? So like for me at that stage of my evolution as a shaper, that would have been really hard to get right.
Right.
And, the precision it was kind of an entry thing. Like, okay, make a twin fin if the rails are a little too thick or whatever. It didn't really matter.
Yeah.
So I think it was probably an ease thing.
But were you also riding Kelly Slater's elf slippers? Like, were you riding like 17 and a half inch boards and then also riding these wide twin fins? Like,
no, that's a good question. Yeah. So I was riding the twin fins for fun, but when I was surfing, I was riding long short boards. So they were all 18 and a quarter, 18 and a half, and 6'4", 6'6". So because I'm taller and I weighed more. So I thought I had to go proportionate. Back in those days, everything was proportionate. So I like when the surf was good and I was going to Hawaii and surfing bigger waves around town, it was always performance board.
Right.
So I still wanted to have that, but I slowly started, but I didn't want to surf mine because I was surfing for Rusty at the time, and Rick Hammond was the shaper, and his boards, he's a master. So I just surfed his boards.
And so, you started dabbling with these other boards, but I'm sure a part of it was, well, just kind of like what you said, like you saw your buddy just like giggling to himself, right? He's riding that twin and he's like, I want some of that. Right. And so started shaping these alternative boards, even though you were kind of like this hardcore comp surfer.
Right.
And then I'm assuming that you know, you, so where did it go from there? Were you just like, hey, these are the boards that people are just buying. These are the boards that people like better. And so I just kept on going with that. Or did it end up influencing your other surfing as well? Like, so what was the interaction there?
Yeah, that's a good question. So where I went from there is in 2001 is when I got real serious. I had, at the time my son was born, I started a business and I bought a house all in the same year. And so it was game time and I was going to be the breadwinner for the family kind of thing. And, so at that point I owned a glass factory and we would, do the contract glass work for Channel Islands and Rusty and Xanadu, and a bunch of, you know, really top shapers, top brands. And so I would handle, we were doing 120 boards a week. And so I was handling, I was the guy going and picking them up, taking them back, shaping 6-7 boards a day myself, and then, you know, helping move boards around the shop. So I was just completely immersed in surfboards for 5 solid years of intense work. And I was ghost shaping for Channel Islands, and I was ghost shaping later after that episode, I was shaping some JSs. So or being around those boards, the precision and the accuracy required for a performance board and all the different components and how they come together and what does what, if you take a little too much off there or put too much there, all that in precision, I started getting really jonesed on and really getting behind that, and then applying that precision and accuracy into the performance, into like small wave performance boards, into grovelers, into all kinds of funky, like 4-fin twin fins and like eggy weird boards, carving out the decks, like kneeboard guys at San Diego is a hot kneeboard spot. So they would scoop out the bottoms of the decks of their boards so they could fit down in there better. Just all kinds of funky things. And I had the glass shop so I could try everything. So that's, I was just like working a lot and working really hard, just not saying no to any kind of custom and really putting my all into each custom and really trying to nail it for the guy, you know?
Hey everyone, it's Van. Hopefully you've been enjoying the podcast. Hopefully you've been listening to some good stories, getting some good tips that are helping you improve as a surfer. If so, make sure to subscribe to the podcast, leave us a review. It'll only take you literally a few seconds, and share it with your friends. That's the best way you can support me so I can continue to create awesome new content for you. So thanks. Huh. I feel like that's actually a really fascinating kind of background, because you're coming from this high performance world, right? In terms of you're ghost shaping for all these guys. So you understand that precision is necessary, but then most of your boards are kind of your more user-friendly boards. Yeah. And it's this interesting marriage of the two. And I can see how there's going to be some synergy from the combination of the two. And it's interesting because when I think about your boards before you start shaping for Kelly, I was always like thinking, you know, the baked potato, the Dominator, all user-friendly boards. Yeah. But like, a big part of that DNA, though, is kind of like what you've learned shaping high performance Channel Islands and then using that and infusing that into these small wave boards. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So you started doing everything under the sun. You just start experimenting with a bunch of different things. So then, like, you know, where does the Dominator, where do these boards come from, you know?
Okay. So I'll add to that. We early on, back when Clark was in business and before 2005, we were doing, I was really interested in EPS and carbon fiber back then. 2002, we started getting into that. And so I right away started realizing how the materials change how you shape. And right. Then let's talk about synergy. Those different designs become completely different when you made a baked potato out of a PU and it was 8, 9, 10 pounds versus a high, you know, really lightweight baked potato, then the performance is completely different. And then if you make it out of a quad with fin boxes and all that stuff. So I got really interested in the materials. And then
I remember you were one of the first ones to, do the vacuum sealing boards. I remember, like, that's what dark arts are now. And that those guys have blown up. But I remember you doing it like, I don't know how many years ago at this point, but
interesting. And so that was that, a lot of that influence was from the guys who made boats and prone paddleboards in my area. And Mike Eaton was one of those guys. And so he was messing with all kinds of different materials. So then you go to answer your question about the Dominator. The reason, one of the reasons why it's so successful is because of it. It's lighter. It has materials that bend and allow it, that thicker, fuller body to bend and perform instead of being a big, thick, rigid, or, you know, sort of like that thuddy kind of not alive feeling that a thicker PU can kind of diminish some of the liveliness of the board. And so it's not a throwaway board or anything like that, but you can just enhance the performance of it by using different materials. So I would say that my understanding of the materials and the shaping together was one of the things that led to the Dominator and the Sweet Potato making sense early 2010. That was like 2008 was the Dominator, 2009 and 10 was the Sweet Potato. And that potato generation started then.
And so how did those, when you were thinking about designing them, you're just like looking at a normal shortboard, because, you know, the Dominator, I mean, the Baked Potato is like totally different from a normal shortboard of that era, but like the Dominator 2 is more similar. But what was going on in your mind? Like, how did you end up like in, you know, going with the design? It's this rounder shape versus your normal boards. Like, how did that come to life? Where did it come from beyond the materials?
I would say not being afraid of the more, so that Mike Eaton guy and Stu both were kind of mentory for me. They made a lot of those. What was the, the other really cool board that Rusty would shape was called, he had a brand called Music, Wayne Lynch style boards. And so Nat Young and those guys, the shortboard revolution, Stu and Mike Eaton were really different eras. They were 20, 30 years apart in age, but they were very influenced by that shortboard revolution era. And they didn't go straight to the pointy, you know, Merrick Slater mid-90s design. There was the evolution there of the early 70s, mid-70s, late 70s. And so not being afraid of those fuller outlines, because of my mentors, because of my relationship with longboarding, made me go, okay, we can make the Dominator work. And the reason the Dominator, the very first one in 2008, I mean, I banged that thing out the initial design took 10 minutes. And the wide point is 3 inches back from center. If you look at McCoy's old Shane Horan boards and Mike Eaton boards, the wide points are way back so that you're standing over the widest point of the board. So when you're standing there trimming and starting to pick some speed, the widest planing area is between your legs, between your feet, or behind your front foot.
Between your feet, behind your front foot. Interesting. Uh-huh.
And so that took away all that pendulum feeling of a longer. If you take a sort of the traditional idea of a groveler, a lot of those guys put the wide point forward. And so that creates a swing, which is fine. And like, you see guys like Dane Reynolds and stuff like that ripping on those boards. But then the average user, when the whole world of what that board can be, when you move the wide point back for the average user, turns into a whole different thing. And I think that's all it really was. A rare aircraft going overhead. I think the fin placements are far forward. And that wide point coming back opened up a playing field that hadn't been open until that point. And I wasn't afraid of it because of the influences from my mentors. Yeah.
That was actually one of the questions that I had for you, is that decision to go wide point back. Cause you know, when you look at the dims on the Dominator, I mean, just looking at the Dominator 2, right. And it's so different from your normal board. So like the wide point is shifted back. And then the fins are shifted forward a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, and when you think about a standard shortboard, usually that wide point is shifted a little bit back, right? Mm-hmm. But this, you know, when you look at the outline, it seems much more pronounced. It seems like there's just more foam kind of pulled back. So it's actually meant for that wide point to be actually a little bit behind your back foot. Interesting.
Behind your front foot, yeah.
Or, sorry, behind my front foot, yeah.
Yeah, yep.
And that's interesting. So... So this is actually one of the questions that I had for you as well. So I'm actually, because Noel recommended it, I was like, all right, well, I got to try this thing. So I was looking at one, and I'm sure that there are tons of other people that listen to my podcast that probably can empathize with this, but I have more of a narrow stance. Like, I'm not a tall, lanky dude. I have more of a narrow stance, right? And so sometimes I struggle to get my back foot all the way back, especially when I'm riding a longer board. So like if I'm looking at, you know, the 5.4, that's kind of the size that I'll probably get, right? It's the Dominator 2, 5.4, 19.38, 2.25, and it's 26 liters or so.
Okay.
Like the equivalent Sharp Eye 72, which is not exactly the same board, but that's your more traditional, you know, high performance, or it's a small wave, let's call it small wave, short board. That thing's like 5.8 and 18.75, you know, and that's at 25.5 liters.
Okay.
And, you know, so that's an extra 4 inches. So when you pop up, and I don't have the 5.8, I have the 5.7, which is 25 liters, and it's like 18.65. But my naturally, because that wide point is shifted a little bit far forward, it's still wide point. I'd probably say it's like wide point more like center.
Okay.
Balance. And so like, you know, when you're paddling on a longer board, and that you kind of rest on the board where the widest point of the board is, because that's where you're going to be able to like tip in. But when you pop up, your back foot is much more further forward.
Yeah. Proportionate.
Proportionally. And so I was like, huh, this actually, I wonder if the Dominator 2 would like help with that, because the Y point is kind of back and it's shorter. So you just end up popping up in the right spot more often. Like, is that a way to solve that? Or what do you recommend for like a tall, lanky surfer versus a shorter, stockier surfer who are the same weight, you know?
I think I'd recommend the same thing for both of us, because I have the same discipline problem. For me, it's a discipline thing where I hop up and I'm already a little too far forward. So I got to adjust and get my foot back. So the first thing is to be disciplined and just be conscientious of it. Just like, I'm going to get my foot back on, even if I look like a total kook and I blow it, I'm going to have my foot all the way back. Or at least if I'm going down the line, I'll have it on the middle of the pad. And then when I go, I'm not going to initiate a turn until it's up against the kick pad. So that kind of discipline. The other thing as just as a surfer, I recommend it to, I was just talking to my friend about it, is when you hop up, just do one little shimmy with your front foot, get your front foot back. And then that automatically draws your back foot back. So it's almost like getting the discipline of moving your back foot back. It is initiated by doing just a little, you see the top guys do it all the time. They do a little, and so that's one thing. The other thing is that's a little trickier to do, but it also encourages my flag that I raise about get faster at paddling, everybody, because if you can get really strong at paddling, you're going to be getting into the wave. First of all, you're going to be getting into it earlier. You're going to be coming into it with more speed. With those two things, you're going to catch more waves. And then with all that in place, when you go to get up, put your hands on where you're going to hop up just a little further back. I mean, just like, you know, you go to put if your hands are here to when you get up normally, just do one little, you know, not even an inch. And then that'll put you, you know, proportionally quite a bit further back, requiring a less of that discipline I talked about at the beginning of the question.
Yeah.
So those are my big points for that.
But then, so those are very good points, and I'm glad you share them. But like, you know, what's your height versus what board, you know, Dominator 2 do you ride? And do you still have a problem getting your back foot back even on like a shorter board like that, or?
No. Not as much. So my take on boards for the high performance, from the Dominator all the way to like the S Boss type boards, when I'm riding them as low on the volume that I can for my size and my age, I'm riding around 33 liters right now, and I'm 190 pounds, and I'm like, I don't know, maybe a little over 6'2". So, but what I struggle with from an aesthetic standpoint is, if you take a guy like Owen Wright, who has to compete in the wave pool against Philippe Toledo, Owen's going to be riding normally like a 6'1", And, you know, his whole thing was to, so I'm a little bit more on the, oh, not that I surf anywhere close to him, but like, you know, that taller lanky problem and getting a board that looks mm-hmm. how we all kind of want to see the board right. work and fit on each wave.
Right.
And the reason I was using the wave pool experience or example is because we're so used to seeing a 5'7", 5'8", 5'9" in those churns. You take a big guy on a 6'1", it's going to look funny. And it's going to, our eyes are going to be like, why is that so different? You know? And so those guys all figured that out right away. And they were trying to get their volume from a 6'1" to fit and still be a high performance board in the 5'11", 5'10" range so that they could look how everyone expects them to look in that surf. And I'm in that camp. The whole lining up your height with your board, that works for Kelly because he's already 5'9", you know, right. and he likes 5'9s and 5'10s. So that scale doesn't work for all the bodies out there. And right. so I'm riding a board that's shorter and wider and thicker. My boards are a lot thicker. My personal boards are really thick in the center. And then the rails, you would never know it because you can feel the rail. And then I have a lot of foam on the deck forward for paddling. And then that Y points back. So I'm messing around with that stuff because of all those different variables that someone my size has to contend with.
That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. So it's what's fascinating to me is that, and now it's making sense where these potato designs came from. You're trying mm-hmm. to solve for like a shorter board for a taller guy.
Yep.
Especially as well, if you're surfing smaller waves, you want something that's going to fit in that pocket, right?
You're
not going to be able to do like a turn on a 6'1" in a 2-foot wave, 3-foot
right.
wave, right?
Yeah.
So you're going for that shorter board. But it's interesting because I feel like even though I'm definitely not 6'2", like it's going to help me because I still want a shorter board for my more mm-hmm. narrow stance. And then,
right.
you know, Noel Salas, you know,
he's riding the 5'4" too.
He likes the 5'4" because he's like, even though, you know, he can surf all of these boards well, he's like, I still like the shorter board, just the reaction time. There's no swing weight and all these things.
Yeah.
It's so interesting. And so mm-hmm. the other question I had, so the wide point back that changes things, but like, you know, the width when I'm looking at the dims again, I'm trying to wrap my head around it. You know, the Dominator 2 is 19 3/8 versus mm-hmm. my Rocket Y is 19 3/4. It's like, you know, that's a considerable additional amount of width. But like, mm-hmm. and the thickness is fairly similar. The Rocket Y is just like a 1/16 thicker.
Okay.
But like, yep. you know, is it? I mean, I guess you probably don't ride those normal boards. But like, is it? Even though there's going to be more width, is it? How does it? It looks like Noel's turning on it just fine, right? But mm-hmm. like, how is it going to? Am I going to have problems getting it on rail, or is it going to be fine because that Y points back, so it's going to be looser? Like, how do I think about that?
Well, I mean, so the other factor that is just the pixie dust magic thing, where you know, where we like certain songs and don't like certain other songs, you know, and so there's that factor inside the board too. But as far as like for a board like the Dominator, the width and the volume, all that's a factor. But then what it comes down to is sort of the relationship of the way it lines up with you, with or a surfer, and the willingness of the surfer to get the fins dialed for any board, like the Dominator or whatever brand, PU or anything like that. You can get used to whatever board yeah. you want, and right. and so from a business standpoint, what I've been trying to do in the last 10, 15 years is design boards that cover as many of those surfers as possible in each dimension.
Yeah.
So that's one factor. The other factor, so there's some design, bottom contours, rocker, fin placement that I can open up that field of usability for a lot of different people. The other factor is material. So like if it's a rigid, or if it's thick, or if it's, you know, heavy or dense, a lot of the sensation that we're feeling isn't necessarily the whole board bending, but it's the way the deck skin that we're stepping on is vibrating. And I think a lot of the reason why the volcanic lamination for Firewire, or you mentioned Dark Arts before, the the whole board isn't necessarily bending, I don't think, but I mean, it is in certain moments, but what you're feeling is the pushback of the top layer of material. And so a lot of this, a lot of the positive feedback that your brain's getting is happening in that relationship. So there's material, there's the shape, there's the bottom contour, there's fin plate, you know, all those things that will. So when you get back to the width, how you ask the question, I think the width starts looking less consequential compared to your overall relationship. Even volume starts playing a different role with your relationship with that board, you know, and planing surface is a big, big deal. I think it was Bill Stewart really berating people who cared about volume. And I thought it was a little extreme, but he had a great point in that, that he was talking about planing surface and the way like a skim board has, I don't know, 12 liters of volume, and guys are skimming, you know, over, they're hauling ass and it's rad. Pipos and all those different kinds of boards do the same thing. So volume isn't everything, width isn't everything. It's the overall.
Right.
I don't know if I answered your question, but
no, I mean, I think that's part of the magic of your boards is someone, you just got to experiment with it and try it. And I think that, you know, because I know compared back to back, it's like, I'm on the Dominator, then I'm on the Sharp Eye, and then I'm on like a Cabianca. Mm-hmm. And those two boards are your normal traditional shortboard style. And then the Dominator 2, the dims are just kind of like out there, but like, he doesn't have any problems like putting on a rail. So I'm like, all right, well, you know, it should go. And I would imagine, you know, I totally agree about that surface area. I would imagine it's going to have more natural built-in speed because of that width, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's probably, and I'm guessing are probably going to be more refined at that greater width. So you can still tip it on. I mean, I haven't felt one yet, but that'd be my guess. So it's all fascinating how all these things come together. I guess it'll be, I saw one for sale on Craigslist. So I'm going to try to pick one up and see.
Yeah, good.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think everybody should experiment a little bit with, you know, definitely experiment, you know, you never know what kind of magic you're going to find.
Yeah. And that's what's cool about companies like FireWire. I think Channel Islands does a lot, you know, a lot of the companies are offering up demos, especially through tea shops. San Diego, I think Surfride has, you know, in Claremont Surf Shop, they all have huge rental now as well. There's and then also just huge amounts of demos. JS has demos, and just opening up your mind and just kind of, I mean, gosh, you know, just the attitude of surfing. Everyone's so serious and like, man, you know, if you could just take the foot off the gas a little bit and like, you know, experiment and just ride waves and then be real conscientious of where your feet are, what you're feeling and all those kinds of things. And just try as many different types of boards as you can. You're going to become like, I'm obsessed with this 511 S-Boss I have. And I keep remaking it to exactly how my original one was, which was messed up. I screwed up on it. And so like, I'm trying to mess up again, to reproduce the magic. But I also ride a 6'8" mid-length board that we were experimenting with FireWire. It's going to be called the Boss Up. And I ride this board I make called the All-in-One, and I make them as light as possible, 7 feet to 10 feet. And you just learn a lot about surfing in general and your surfing as specifically, and how you can improve and paddle speed and things like that, and how they play a role.
Well, tell us about the S-Boss, because I know you just released it. So, you know, it sounds like you're obsessed with it right now. Like, what's the DNA behind the S-Boss?
Yeah, so that board's, I'm genuinely still, it's the only board I ride, for when the surf's good. It's the unique thing about that is the design of it has a V. And so it's a double barrel V. The double barrel makes sense because of the potato world. I'm used to that. And then, but I always, whenever I surfed V bottoms from, I think the mid 80s, all the way through, kept trying them. I never liked them because it always felt like there was a governor on the speed. So it'd be like, cool, your paddling was great. Get up, start getting going, and it was great. And then as soon as you start getting into a critical speed where you can start doing really fast, big churns, it had a top end. And I didn't like that. And so Kelly came to me with the idea of doing a V with the double barrel and had all these ideas and a bullet nose. And I'm like, everything sounded cool. And I'm like, are you cool with this rock or cool with this tail? He's like, yeah. But I want the V. And I'm like, it's going to push water, you know? And so I made him the board, and I made him three boards. He really liked it. And then said, what do you think of it? I'm like, I haven't even made myself one yet. He goes, why? I said, cause V sucks, you know? And he goes, no, what are you talking about? He got mad. And so I'm like, all right, well, I better hurry and make myself one. So I did. And you know, that was why I screwed up the glass job. And I screwed up that first one. And I, the very first wave, it wasn't pushing water. And it was because of the way we did the double barrel and the way that all the V and double barrel under your front foot transition out the tail with where the fins were in the rocker, created a whole situation where there was no governor, and the top end speed was just from the very small waves to huge, juicy waves. It handled the speed, and then that V created so that you didn't have that flutter on top of water. It sliced water, and so I can't get enough of that design. I've tried it on a couple of different little outlines and different bodies of boards. And we put it on an FRK. It goes pretty good. Like it's a, that was the longish answer to the DNA of the board is all those pieces coming together.
And so like, you know, when you think about the potato, I know there's double barrel, but it's not like V. Like
it's
when you say
concave.
V, the V, you know, it's in that concave, but this is V where it's, you know, if you were to put a ruler on the bottom of the board, it would actually go back and forth because that V sticks out. Yes. Normally you'll hear of like V on like the tail of a twin fin to settle it down, right?
But
this
tail,
thing is like, this is V all the way down the middle of the board. Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Till right in front of the fins. And then it goes into more of a traditional exit of concave out the tail, more like the FRK. Mm-hmm.
So how would you, you know, if I mean, maybe this is just me having to like reprocess it again, but like, you know, your typical shortboard is going to be like single to double, you know, out the back, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how's this going to feel differently versus like that traditional single to double?
I didn't notice any transition time problem. That might be because it's just so forgiving with that V adds forgiveness, and the bullet nose makes it so also. So it's really easy to tip, but it's not overly sensitive.
It kind of
goes back to the pixie dust. I'm not
right.
Totally
it's that,
sure.
Like that magic,
you know,
I mean, I'm sure so much of it is right. Like,
I could spew like I know everything, but
right.
A lot of it's just like, I don't know. It just works good.
Yeah. That's
sweet. I have my theories, but you know.
Yeah. Interesting. And then where does this slot in the quiver? Does it sit above the Dominator 2 or?
Yeah, so I would have the Dominator 2 for just more fat, slower waves. And this board would be for any small wave that has a little curve to it, that's punchy.
Yeah.
And more facey, I'd go more towards the Dominator, even in the potato world. Yeah.
Got it. Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. I was looking at the S-Boss too, and the dims look more like normal shortboard kind of dims. Uh-huh. And I was like, oh, this definitely looks really interesting. I like the length of it as well. Mm-hmm. I like that snub nose and the pulled in tail. It definitely looks very interesting. So I'm super excited. Too many boards to buy. That's the problem. I'm going to give you all my cash.
You got to hit those demos.
I guess so. And then so going all the way up to the high end then. So, you know, Kelly Slater ends up using, you know, you end up designing, you know, he's known for having like super knifed out, super sensitive boards. And then you're known for creating these super user friendly boards. Like how did you guys end up working together? I mean, obviously through FireWire, but like, how did you become the one that ends up shaping like his standard shortboard? It just seems like an interesting connection there.
Yeah. I'm sure luck had something to do with it. And then, my obsession at the timing when I first made him, the first two boards I made him was 2015. And I'd been coming out of, you know, that was at that time, really, really hardcore working, making you know, 6 days a week working on boards, and a lot of them were high performance short boards. And I also knew his surfing really well. I'd always watched him since he was little. And then, obviously when he won, the Bud event in lowers, and I think that was 19, I think I was 89 because we graduated the same year in high school in 90, I think we're the same age, but, yeah. So I've been watching his surfing for a long time. I'd been neck deep in design. And then the about 4 months before I shaped those boards, we were in Australia together at the same time, not together, but same time. And he was looking at a unibrow board of mine that was a little more performance board oriented. So it was like a short, squatty FRK, mm-hmm. but not less concave and less racy. But it was a personal board of mine, and it was sitting on the ground, and he was walking by, and he goes, yeah, I like, what do you think of that tail? And I said, oh, I love it. You know? And he goes, I think it's too curvy right here. And he pointed with his toe. I like it having a straight spot right behind the fin, the front fins. He said, I like a little straight spot right here. And then he pointed with his toe at the tip of the tail. He goes, I like that to be more blunt. And I was like, huh, interesting. You know, that, and it makes sense because if you look at his surfing, he's just driving the tail of the board through churns so hard with his toe and heel edge. And so it made sense. And then when I decided to make him the boards in that July in 2015, I knew to do that. And so it took forever shaping these two boards and then stressing out about it. And then he didn't ride them, you know, for 2 years. And that's a true story. And, so yeah. And then, and I forgot all about him and I was just doing my thing. And then 2017, he gets a hold of me and he's like, hey, what'd you do with these boards? And I'm all, what do you mean? And I'm like, you know, and I reminded him of the conversation and, in Australia. And he goes, he's all, my friend was surfing this board here. It was a 5.9 and I thought it was too small for me. So I let him just use it. And he's all, you're going to like this board. And Kelly said, no, it's too small. And he caught a couple more waves there out at lowers. And He's all, you're going to friggin' love this thing. And he shot it over to him. Let's switch boards. And so they switched boards. And Kelly said the very first pump, he just was like, what the hell? This thing's insane. And so I think that what went into that board is what he knew he liked, what I had seen him like over the years. And then I snuck in and hit a lot of foam so that he could, you know, catch waves easier. And again, it's the in front of your front foot on the deck, it's a little fuller there, but then you hide it all. So you pick it up and you can't feel it. It's a thin bladey rail. Like you're talking about his boards being ultra, ultra sensitive, ultra high performance. And, but if you sneak in the forgiveness and stuff that they don't, you know, guys, top pro guys still want that too. If they can get it, they don't want it to be overly twitchy as well. You know, it adds forgiveness and it smooths out mistakes they might make.
Right.
So that was kind of what went into it. And then we refined a couple more versions of it. And then that went into becoming the FRK model that was released, I think in 2019.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, what is the revision iteration process with someone as precise and knowledgeable about boards with, like he is, you know, is he like, you know, super specific with his feedback? Is he like, all right, I want you to add an eighth of an inch here or whatever, or what is that like?
Yeah, it can be. There's a lot of times where there was a board we did for last year, J-Bay, that he got like that with. He was like, there's this rocker. And this rail, and I need to, you know, and he got really precise and he wanted to have it work with these bigger front fins, these twinnies and, his Endorphin twinnies. And, so he was getting like that. There's other times where like we made some boards for Barra, in, I think it was 20, whenever the most recent Barra was that 21 around then. And I knew Barra and I knew his surfing. And so like on a situation like that, I knew what to make him. And I made him a 5.9, a 5.8, 5.9, 5.10. And then, two of them. Yeah. Two, two five nines. And so I knew in that situation what he would need, and he ended up loving the boards. He wanted some foil differences coming from previous board. So he'll get into some specifics and then leave. Once he knows I have a general idea of what he's wanting, he'll also back off and just kind of let me do kind of predict and guess those kind of iterations. And then, but for something like Bell's or Margaret's, that's when he gets real focused and determined to have his input in on the boards.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It sounds like, you know, the pros have different approaches. Like I'll hear about John, where obviously he'll like work on boards for like months with Pizel beforehand, but then he'll be like, all right, this is the ghost. This is my plan, my A ghost and my B ghost. And then he just rides that most of the year. But it sounds like you guys are dialing in sets of boards for every spot. And it sounds like a lot of work for you though.
Yeah.
Interesting. You know?
Yeah. It's super interesting. I love it.
Yeah.
But you're right though. Ultimately, it seems to me like his original FRK, he kept it until 2020. And then I got it, you know, I stole it. But that board, you know, he rode it everywhere too though. So it's kind of like what you're saying is they have ideas. A lot of the times it seems like other guys are the same way as Kelly, like you're saying with John. I want this, I want that, needs refinements, tweak the rocker here. But then they go back to a board they just love. And that's the pixie dust thing. You know, it's like, well, this board just works. I just know it. I'm familiar with it. I know where my feet go right in the right spot. And so it's kind of, you, right when you think you know the answer, someone will do something and you won't know the answer anymore.
Right. So. All right. Well, we've gone all the way up. You know, in turn, because you're talking about how you're dialing in boards for like every single like increment of like size of wave and whatnot. So like FRK and FRK plus are probably going to sit above the S boss, right? Let's go back to the very bottom end because we didn't get into that. You know, you mentioned you like to surf small crappy waves. Like, what are equipment advice you give, and then just general advice you'd give on surfing small waves well, especially if you do it a lot?
Yeah. So for junk waves, I would say that planing surface and volume, you want to like tune that in for yourself. And the advice I give for it would be experiment a lot. And then really, you're going to want to spend a lot of time on fins. So another rule on fins that I abide by is the slower you're going, the bigger the fin you actually want it to be. And what I think a lot of designs get wrong, where I feel like because I spend a lot of time in that world of groveling around, especially when I'm in Southern California, is getting those bigger fins in the right place. So if you put bigger fins and they're marked and put into a box that's too far back, it's going to be boggy and it's going to feel like it's put on sideways. You know, it's going to feel horrible. Because ultimately the fin is a power source and you're going to be able to push off of it. So if it gets up under your feet and more between your feet relative to a traditional fin placement, you're going to be able to use that as a whip, you know, as a catapult to project and traject your momentum forward, especially right when you get takeoff. So get strong, work out, paddle, get real comfortable physically and don't underestimate the importance of that. And then tune in your boards and really think about like how you can utilize the surface area and the fin combination together. And then don't be afraid to ride a board with hardly any rocker in it. That's another thing I see other designs do. It's hard for shapers who make performance boards to realize how little rocker you can get away with. And so if you move the fin forward, wide point back, and lower the rocker, you got all the juice in the right spots. It's just distributed differently.
And especially if it's super short too, like, you know, your sweet potato, because then there's no nose to catch or anything. It'll just fit in that pocket because it's really, really small. Interesting.
Yeah, it fits. Mm-hmm.
You know, it is interesting. I have a buddy. He's been riding a baked potato for like years. Mm-hmm. And I feel like part of the reason why he's gotten so good is because he just surfs all the time, number one.
Yeah.
You know, like he'll go out when I would be like, oh, that doesn't look good. And just go out and surf all the time.
Yeah.
And you can surf it relatively performance, you know, and like mm-hmm. do turns on it because again, like, you know, most people are riding a log at that point, but he still gets to rip around on it. So
mm-hmm.
he credits it as being one of the key things that has helped him really progress.
And sticking to one shape kind of thing.
He's been riding that same. Well, he went from a baked potato to a twice baked in the wood technology. I forget
which timber one. Tech. Yeah, yeah.
The timber tech. Yeah, he's just been riding that like nonstop for. Okay, I don't even know how long at this point.
And yeah, I can appreciate that too, because in order to really understand what's going on, you need to be very familiar with the board.
Yeah. Yeah. Well. Definitely seems like it does the job. All right. Yeah. Well, I think I've covered everything I set out to cover. Any last shout outs for you? All right.
Yeah. I appreciate it. Where are you? You're on.
Yeah. I live in Brooklyn in New York.
Okay.
So I surf Rockaway. I travel a decent amount as well.
Cool.
Yeah.
Do you see
I don't know Ron personally, but I've definitely seen him around. I've heard of him for sure. And I know that he gets tons of boards from you. So
Yeah. He's one of those guys. You can just go make him be your friend. Cool. No, that's good. I like New York. I like the whole, I got to get out there more. I'm trying to plan a trip for the fall out there.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Let me know when you're in town. Hey, it was very nice to chat. Appreciate you coming on.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Hey, everyone. It's Van. Hopefully, you've been enjoying the podcast. Hopefully, you've been listening to some good stories, getting some good tips that are helping you improve as a surfer. If so, make sure to subscribe to the podcast, leave us a review. It'll only take you literally a few seconds, and share it with your friends. That's the best way you can support me so I can continue to create awesome new content for you. So, thanks.